We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. This is our 18th episode, and later on we'll be joined by Dr. Daryl Ray, the founder of Recovering from Religion, author of Sex and God and the God Virus. So you definitely don't want to miss that part.
Good times were had.
We are recording this for release on January 10, 2013, and joining me as always is Wesley. Wesley, how's it going?
Hello, I'm doing wonderful.
Oh, and I forgot to say that I'm Dustin.
He's Dustin.
Yes, I'm Dustin. And I'm also doing well.
I do have to throw this out here.
Oh, please do.
Government building. We had like a Christmas break, holiday closure, whatever you want to call it. We were closed for like 10 days. No heat in the building whatsoever. Turned it on this morning. I got there. I could see my breath in the building for half the day. Froze my fucking tootsies off.
Huh.
Tell you what. Just, yeah, gotta tell you, I actually had to suffer for my work today.
It's about time.
Yeah, it's not that I worked, I just had to suffer at work.
Oh, man, if there was karma, that would be justice.
There really isn't.
Actually, that still wouldn't be enough.
No.
No, I've actually been enjoying having the week off. I always work all around Thanksgiving and Christmas, you know, day before, day after, all that kind of stuff. Any shift I need to help free up other people on the management team to have, you know, some time off to see family. And then I take the entire week of New Year's off.
Nice.
And yes.
So you're off right now.
Yes. Yes. This is January 2nd, and I got up at 12:30.
Yeah. You're going to fuck your sleep up for next week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, and then next week I head off to Phoenix on business, so yeah, this is going to be interesting, especially since in Phoenix I'll be likely, I'll be having to get up pretty early to go to class, and I'll be at the bar late every night while I'm there.
Oh, I'm sure. So we're going to make our formal announcement here?
Yes, we have a couple of announcements. Well, the first one's a big announcement. Northwest Freethought Alliance Conference is coming up, as you all know, April 5, 6, and 7. 2013. You'll be able to see Dr. Daryl Ray give the main keynote address, and again, you'll get to hear him a little bit later. He's doing the banquet, talk. Hemet Mehta is going to be doing the Saturday luncheon. Valerie Tarico is going to be the closing keynote on Sunday. Shelley Siegel is going to be opening for Daryl Ray with music, and for one of the workshops, we're going to be recording a live episode.
So what do you think? Should we do some Q&A with the audience?
I
know we'll have Daryl there.
Yes.
At least that's the hope.
What I pitched to Robert Sanford is we're going to start with just a little bit on the kind of setup that we use for it, you know, the kind of the technical side. And I do hope to be able to also be doing this live on Google Hangouts on air. So nice. Even if you miss the conference, you'll be able to watch it live and get the full thing, because what we're actually going to be releasing for the podcast will just be the main part, unless I get a bunch of feedback saying, give us all of it, but you could just watch YouTube for that. Anyway, we'll be doing, starting off with, how we do it, record the first part of the episode. So we'll go through all the news and all that kind of stuff, have some time for Q&A from the audience, and go into the post-production as well.
Excellent.
And so anybody coming and listening to that should have all the information needed on how to do your own podcast. So yes, if you're in Portland or you can get to Portland, definitely come check us out. By now you've missed the early registration discount, but register for the conference. It's always a great time. And with Daryl, Shelley, and Hemet at the bar, oh man, that's going to be awesome.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that'll be a good time.
This will be my third, actually.
Ditto. So, yes, come see us and buy Wesley a drink.
Yes, please. I'm a cheap date.
Other thing I have is I was actually quoted in the Idaho Statesman last week. This was a story that was in the works few days before, I was contacted by the reporter working on the story. And because I'd written a couple blog posts about this billboard, she came across one of those and wanted to comment. And so what had happened was there's this highway evangelism billboard in Nampa, Idaho, and it normally has the most lame cliche statements and or Bible verses printed on it. And it looks, it's hideous. I mean, absolutely hideous. They've got a open book painted on a black background with a cheesy reader board on it. It is the most poorly designed thing ever. And so what really got me into this article was the fact that in a blog post about a year and a half ago, I called it a hideous eyesore. And so
the truth hurts.
Yeah. So it had a malfunction about a month ago, and it's completely out of service. So right now they're trying to raise money to repair it and hopefully do some major upgrades. But they get a $1 per year lease on this land that it's on.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
From what I was understanding, it's a pretty old sign. It's kind of electronic or something, mm-hmm. and they're having problems replacing the parts.
Yeah. Yeah,
that they're just not made anymore.
Uh huh.
So yeah, from what I understood, it would be like $100,000 to repair or replace this thing.
Yeah. If they do, I definitely hope that they
spend a few bucks and get somebody that knows what they're doing.
Get something decent, something that's not quite so hideous. I would much rather be able to just say they're idiots, then they're idiots with a hideous sign. But that's kind of beside the point. But what was really nice with this, and this was in the Idaho Statesman, which is the actual serious daily paper based out of Boise. Hmm. It was a very well-written and comprehensive article. It went into details on the equipment, what would have to be done to fix it, the history on it, and alternative views, which is where I came in, and I pointed her towards Paul Rolig, the media representative for the Treasure Valley Coalition of Reason. So she got some comment from him about the billboard campaign that we did last summer for the launch of the Coalition of Reason. And it was really nice to see how much real estate we got in that article for disagreeing with the religious.
Yeah, I was actually very impressed with it. I mean, you didn't come off as a dick, and I'm not saying that you would have, but there's ways to make anybody sound that way.
Here was the interesting thing for me was I was contacted for comment and initially just said, yes, I will give you a comment. But I took about 24 hours to really mull it over what I wanted to say. And mm-hmm. I gave her basically three lines. She used parts of two of them, and I kept it very concise and to the point. And I tried to make it as difficult as possible to turn it against me. But I also looked at it and I was like, okay, what is she wanting here? Is she wanting the angry atheist asshole, or is she wanting,
from what I could tell,
just an alternate viewpoint?
She just wanted alternate.
And, yeah, she just wanted to get both sides of the story. And so, yeah.
Awesome.
Kristen Rodine did a wonderful job with this.
Three cheers.
Yeah. So, Kristen, if you're listening, thank you very much. You did a good job. So yeah, go ahead and links are in the show notes. This has also been on DW Nomad, and him at Meta actually picked it up on Friendly Atheist, so you may have seen it there as well. But check out the article. It was quite nice.
Yay.
All right, time for feedback.
Letters.
So we've got two audio feedbacks today we're gonna share. The first one,
The short one first.
The first one we got on Christmas Eve, and I'll just play it for you right now.
Happy birthday, Jesus!
Yeah, really, that's all there is.
All I can say is, based on the number this came from, it came from Alabama, and my only response...
I love you, man.
This one's actually staying on the soundboard.
Please, man, call back in. We want some more.
Yes.
Oh, that was a nugget of gold right there, man. I'll tell you what.
Oh, yeah.
Keep them coming.
Oh, shit. Okay, so next, we got another response from Ben. He was, I think that's right, kind of cut out a little bit right as he was saying his name. But he was the one who we played his comment about episode 14 last time, about what we were saying about the ethics of do no harm. So we're going to play you his latest. And Ben, please keep on talking to us. This is a interesting discussion.
Hey guys, my name's Ben. I'm from Iowa City. I didn't leave my name last time because I just didn't think about it. There was no attempt at anonymity. I'm calling back again because I feel like I was endeavoring to not sort of poke at Dustin's sort of fresh wound, and I used two kind of flimsy examples to illustrate my point. The context of the do no harm was in the sense that a person shouldn't use an unnamed drug, let's say LSD, because the risks associated could potentially cause severe emotional harm to their loved ones. And I'm saying that I reject that. I do think that people should take their loved ones, and I mean, I'm a firm believer in the be excellent to each other philosophy. However, if a rewarding experience that I want to go on, such as rock climbing, has potential risks, just like an LSD trip would, I don't think a person should close themselves off to those kinds of experiences based on the risks that they contain, based on the emotional harm that would cause to a loved one. That's a bridge too far for me. I don't think somebody should intentionally overdose on drugs, but I don't think the emotional harm it causes others is a good enough reason to say they shouldn't partake in that possibly rewarding experience. Okay, I think that's a better phrasing of what I was trying to get at. Thanks.
Yes, that is a better phrasing. I will agree with you on that point. But what you're failing to take into consideration is risk-benefit analysis. And there is no black and white to ethics. It is various shades of gray. And what I was trying to get at with the do no harm is, in whether or not you're going to be doing something as an ethical person, you should be taking into account some of those risks that people don't often think of. LSD is a poor example because LSD has very minimal risk. Rock climbing is a poor example because rock climbing generally has very minimal risk. And everything we do in life is inherently risky. Just living is risky. But there are things we do every day to mitigate that risk. We look both ways before we pull into an intersection. We wear seatbelts in cars. If you're going rock climbing, you should be going with somebody else, wearing a harness and using all the proper safety equipment, and have a fucking clue as to what you're doing. If you were, say, to be going rock climbing, having never done it, and could actually pull off making it up a very difficult cliff face without any gear, that would be an incredibly stupid thing to do. And I would say it would be an unethical thing to do because you are not only the risk of harm to yourself, but the impact that's going to have on others. And it is a very unnecessary risk. If you know what you're doing, if you're very experienced, and if you're using proper safety gear, there is nothing wrong with rock climbing. Even rock climbing without harnesses and rope, if you know what you're doing, and you're experienced enough to be able to pull that off successfully, and you have somebody else there with you, isn't the same as if you have no clue and you're just going up as high as you can and you're going to fall and crack open your skull.
There just comes to a point where, you know, you have to weigh that the risk versus gain. You know, basically you could just kind of write your life off and just stay inside and sit on the couch all day if you want to take this to extremes. I mean, what if I go outside my door and I'm struck by lightning? That would adversely affect everybody. But
what if you stay in your house and you get hit by a meteorite?
But yeah, it doesn't matter. If you take this to the nth degree, you're paralyzed in what you can do. You have to be able to say, hey, you know what? This needs to be done, or this sounds fun. Let's try and do it safely, have some fun, and go on about your life. Anything taken to excess can be bad or dangerous.
But when taking risks, all factors need to be taken into consideration, including
as
the
best
impact,
as possible.
Yeah, including the impact it's going to have on others. Ah, fuck it. I'm just going to say it. My nephew shot up with heroin. He knew what it was, or he knew what the risks were. He'd been talking to my brother, his other uncle, about it, and admitted to knowing what could happen from it. He knew that if he kept doing it, it would kill him. And it did. That's the type of drug that the risks far outweigh the benefit. LSD is a much different type of substance. It's a lot safer. Marijuana is much safer. Even cocaine is a lot safer. But there are some drugs, like heroin and meth, that are just so incredibly destructive that I don't think you could ever ethically use it, ever ethically get started down that path.
Agreed.
Just agreed. Like how you should never play Russian roulette. But the main point here, take into account the impact it's going to have on others when you make a decision to do something. That's really all I was trying to get at. So, Ben, I hope this has cleared it up for you. Just take the risk into consideration.
If not, send us another note.
Yeah. All right. And we also want to thank Paul and Brian for the kind words they sent us. You can always send us an email, contact@atheistnomads.com. Call us at 541-203-0666. Or leave us a comment on the blog post that comes with the episode and its posting to Facebook and all that kind of stuff.
And don't forget to leave us a comment on iTunes.
Yes. Yes. I haven't checked those in a little while.
Yeah. So if anybody actually uses Apple, please leave a comment. I'm sure there's got to be a couple of you out there.
Wow. You were far more diplomatic in that than I would have been.
Yeah.
All right. You ready for history?
Hey, come on. I'm trying to suck up for a good iTunes review.
All right, I'm going to play the bumper.
All right. All right, this day in history, January 10th, 1901. Oh, this is the day that basically black gold was struck down in Texas. Spindletop Hill, it's near Beaumont, or Beaumont. I'm sure it's Beaumont. I don't care. Anyways, Beaumont. Beaumont. this is Beaumont. Couple guys, they drilled down about 1,000 feet and ended up getting a geyser that was blowing sky high, about 100 foot in the air. And this damn thing actually dropped out about 900,000 barrels before it actually got capped and they were able to harness this oil. And that's pretty much where the start of our great oil industry in our country started. Crazy, yeah. On that. Which is too bad, though. Kind of too bad, though. There's this Texas businessman and like an amateur geologist, Petit O'Higgins. He thought that there was oil in this area, and in the 1890s, he was out there checking around, and damn his luck if he didn't sell off his investment in this company. And not too long after that, they, well, struck oil. So his loss, but everybody else's gain of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is where pretty much every big company that's out there now got their start. Companies like formerly called Humble, it's now Exxon, the Texas Company, now known as Texaco, and Magnolia Petroleum Company, now known as Mobil. They all pretty much started in the same area. So this is a hell of a boom.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
Sweet.
Sweet. All right. Oh, boy. This day in history, January 10th, 1920, the League of Nations is created. So basically, you got all these countries. This is actually during World War One that 42 nations ratified this League of Nations to try and, you know, settle disputes. And, well, it kind of didn't really work.
Well, Woodrow Wilson was the one that really pushed for this idea with the other allies. And mm-hmm. they wanted this organization that would make it so that there would never again be another war. But the problem was they didn't get U.S. Ratification. That was part of it. And the other issue was it had no teeth at all. So it was the League of Nations was completely powerless to prevent another war. Namely, they were powerless, and really the countries behind it, France and Britain, didn't have the balls to step in and do something about Germany rearming. If they had done what they were supposed to, they would have never, World War II would have never happened.
Yeah, and that actually might kind of sound familiar, you know, having a ineffective president, like kind of like Woodrow Wilson. I mean, he advocated this group to get in power, but then you have the Senate basically knocking it back and not getting us approved in there.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of shitty.
Now, even before World War II, they tried to stop Japan from invading China. So Japan
just withdrew.
Yeah. Wow, great organization.
Yeah. So yeah, this project was pretty much doomed from the beginning. But that kind of leads on to January 10th, 1946, the first meeting of the United Nations. So basically, United Nations tried to take over where the League of Nations left off, but with actually having a little bit of a bite to them. Let's see, they actually had 51 nations under their belt, and they convened the first time at Westminster Central Hall in London, England. A week later, the UN Security Council met for the first time. I'm sure you've heard that term before. And establish its rules for procedure.
Yeah, and it was initially formed by all the major allies in World War II, all the allied countries, and even before the formal establishment of the United Nations, the allies were beginning to be known as the United Nations. The Security Council was made up of, or then the major parties in the out of the allies, the victors of World War II, U.S., Britain, France, Soviet Union, and China. Granted, France and China had been conquered in the process, but oh well, they're still victors.
Well, you know, they got to say, hooray, we win too, even though they didn't. We love France.
Yeah.
Really.
Now, what's interesting here with that is that the nations that got into it were kind of, that's created a false impression that the Security Council permanent members are made up of nuclear powers, and that now we should add Pakistan and India and maybe Israel. It had nothing to do with who had nuclear power or nuclear weapons. It's just the countries that were on that were the first ones to get nuclear weapons.
It also just so happens that all of those first countries are also part of the Illuminati. Just putting that out there. So moving right along, January 10th, 2008, the world's cheapest car debuts in India. So here we got the New Delhi Auto Expo in India, and one of the biggest manufacturers out there, Tata Motors, debuted the Nano, the car. They're billing it as the world's cheapest car. They're expecting it to come in around $2,500. It was only like 5 foot wide and 10 foot long, so it looks like that car that Mr. Bean drove. You know, it's really, really tiny. And they also gave it a kind of an odd phrase to it, calling it the people's car, which isn't that what Volkswagen was? Isn't that also the people's car?
Literally.
Yeah, literally, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that kind of weirded me out, but whatever, you know, this little powerhouse is made of plastic and sheet metal, had a 32 horsepower engine. Let's see, it was a 624 cubic centimeter two-cylinder rear-mounted engine that it actually reached speeds of up to 65 miles per hour, I'm guessing on a downslope. It also only had one windshield wiper, which, you know, I think India only has one rain setting anyways. It's either not raining or it's monsoon. So, yeah. Doesn't really matter. So, anyways, yeah, awesome little thing. They had 203,000 pre-orders. Turns out they were only able to have an initial run of 100,000. So they actually did like a lottery. So, but yeah, you know, all this cheap cars talk, you know, it's actually kind of crazy because this is actually the same company that owns a Jaguar and Land Rover. So, damn.
Wow.
They're not that small a player.
Bought them from Ford for $2.3 billion. Hmm.
I mean, that ain't jump change. That so sure is a whole lot of nanos.
They've got some money.
Yeah.
Well, okay. The final starting price of that car was about $2,000.
That's what it came.
By the sounds of it, it was probably really cheap to build.
Yeah.
Significantly no airbags, cheaper. Radios. They made some money off of it.
Oh, I'm sure they did. You know, no company is out there to not make a profit.
Yeah. Well, obviously they already had some serious change since they bought Land Rover and Jaguar before that even went.
Yeah. They bought those the same year that it was announced that they were putting this car out. It actually took a year for that to get put out. It was announced in January 2008, but didn't come out until April 2009.
Yeah. Huh. So it's pretty cool.
Fucking A. They got some bucks.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Time for science. All right, rather than talk about an actually already existing robot, we're going to talk about a theoretical one that NASA's developing. And
sweet.
It's being referred to as being hedgehog-like. One idea from the article in CNET is that if they do actually get public input on what to name it, they should, or some kind of a naming contest, they should go with Sonic. But,
oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. The idea on it, though... the current Curiosity rover, just due to how little gravity is on Mars, 38% of the gravity we have on Earth, it makes everything so much more difficult to do. Just moving is a lot more difficult because you have to make sure that they don't lose traction if they hit a bump. And they're looking at doing stuff on asteroids. And one project they're really designing this for is to go to Phobos, one of the moons of Mars, and actually look at it to see if it's just an asteroid that got trapped or a chunk of Mars that got ejected out.
Ooh.
And there'd be so little gravity on that that
thing could fly away.
They're developing the hedgehog, and it's just this little ball covered in spikes. And it would move around by rolling, kind of like Sonic the Hedgehog, and the spikes would just stick into the ground to hold it in place. It's going to be this a really small rover. Each one's going to be less than 2 feet in diameter. There'd be a mother spacecraft that would deploy each of these and you know, be able to control it. So they'd be able to offload a lot of the computing for it, which would be very helpful for getting the size down. And just let it do its thing as it rolls around all spiky-like.
I just love the term NASA's vomit comet. You saw that down there?
Yeah. Yeah, a aircraft that NASA already has.
I think that's basically they take like a Boeing 747 and just do like hyperbolics with it, aren't they? They just take it up to a high arc, then down with a high arc. So you're essentially falling, but you can't tell because there's no wind.
They go into basically a free fall with it, or as close as you can do to a free fall with a Boeing 747. They create zero gravity, or at least reduced gravity. And so the tests they're going to be doing in the Vomit Comet is going to be just greatly reduced gravity and see if it can stay on its surface.
The way they do reduce gravity is just by lowering the angle of attack a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But anyways,
yeah.
Damn cool.
Yeah. All right. Next.
MRSA.
Yes. MRSA has been, a new MRSA strain has been found in the British milk supply.
Like, and you didn't need another one.
Yeah. This one's actually pretty big. Now, before people start freaking out, like Adventists who have prophecies from Ellen White claiming that in the end days, the animal-based food supply will not be safe. This isn't a case of that. Pasteurized milk will be perfectly fine. Pasteurization kills MRSA. Now, if you're one of those crazy organic nuts that keeps on getting unpasteurized milk, then you're putting yourself at risk of something like this. And while this may kind of counter what I was saying earlier about ethics, you might be doing the world a favor by removing yourself from the gene pool. You might be doing your family a major disservice in the process, though. So, yes, pasteurized milk, please. But anyway, They're finding that this has been spreading like wildfire throughout British farms, where it gets transferred from one cow to a dairy worker or a vet or somebody else working with the livestock, and then it's getting transferred to the next cow. And this is a type of MRSA that could be causing serious problems for people if it starts spreading wildly through the human population. It's bad. One factor with this that's causing it is the indiscriminate use of antibiotics that farmers have been doing popularly for the last few years. They've been including very common and very important human antibiotics. And there are two very bad things you can do with antibiotics to help create these super bugs that are resistant to all antibiotics. One is overuse them. And of course, the other one is to underuse them. And since they're just indiscriminately using them on animals, you're exposing a lot more bacteria to it, and it's bad. So shame on you, people, for being irresponsible.
Side note, did you read my little panda article?
Mm-hmm.
Could be a possible help to counteract.
Fungi
and bacteria.
Yeah, could be.
Okay. Anyways, just putting that out there.
I don't remember exactly what the point was from it, though.
From the panda?
Yeah.
They were able to isolate a compound, a peptide, that basically keeps the pandas from getting a lot of fungi or bacteria infections.
Hmm.
And they were able to synthesize it. It's something AM or something PM.
Okay.
Anyways, yeah, fuck the pandas. They're going to die anyways, but so, at least we synthesized the drug.
So a naturally occurring antibiotic in pandas.
Yeah.
That we could use for people.
Yep.
Until it, too, gets overused on farms and
people
don't complete their courses of it. And then we have bacteria that are resistant to that.
Right. But at least, you know, that'll see us another 20, 30 years into the future, at least.
Hopefully. Moral of the story. Use antibiotics when you need to. Don't use them when you don't need to. Just use them when you need to. And complete the whole fucking course.
Oh, yes. Oh. That's the worst part. Just because you feel better doesn't mean you are, you fucker. Take all your pills.
At the point that you feel better, you've killed enough of it that it's not causing you horrible problems. There's still
it's
some
still
left.
There.
Yeah.
It will come back.
Yeah.
And you're a fucker if you don't take them.
And it'll spread to somebody else and kill them.
Yeah, so it's your fault grandma died.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that was a little harsh. Fuck it.
Okay.
Engraved stone.
Yes. Awesome. Archaeologists in China have found an engraved stone going back 30,000 years. This is the oldest artifact, aside from like animal remains, that they found of Neolithic humans going back that far in China. This has a number of engravings in it, parallel lines, some intersecting lines. You can find pictures of it in the article linked to in the show notes, but pretty cool.
Yeah, it turns out there was this French archaeologist named Henri Brule. He actually saw some of these parallel cuts or incisions back in the 1920s, but, he didn't keep good records, it seems like, so... It looks like other people like Dr. Fei Peng are getting the credit.
Yeah.
So, well, good on them.
Cool.
Okay.
All right. Next up, a study in Scotland is showing that carbon nanotubes can be as dangerous as asbestos.
No.
Yes. Now, this study was looking only at the fiber-like carbon nanotubes, but it does the same thing that asbestos does in causing cancer. You have these little tiny... fibers that are small enough to be inhaled, but too large for the immune system to get rid of. And so they sit there on the surface of your lungs, and your body sees that as a framework that needs to be healed. So it starts scarring up, or no, it cuts the lungs, which creates scar tissue, which ends up creating a framework that the body fills with new cells, and those cells start growing improperly, and you get lung cancer.
Great.
Yeah. So
here I was thinking carbon nanotubes were awesome.
They are. The thing is, though, you need to be careful when involved in the manufacture or disposal process. It's the same thing as asbestos. There are a number of countries out there in particular France and China, that still use asbestos in construction. Russia and Canada are the largest asbestos miners to this day. I've actually been to an asbestos mine in Canada. They get used can make very, very awesome concretes and other brakes. Things like that. Brakes, yes. Now, mm-hmm. brakes would be a bad use for it, though. What you want for something like that, like asbestos or carbon nanotubes, is you use it in something that's going to be enclosed, and you take appropriate measures to protect those that are going to be exposed to loose fibers. And so carbon nanotubes still have wonderful uses. You just need to be careful if they're loose.
Yeah, don't ever breathe the fibers or the freest material.
Don't breathe the dust.
Yep.
And that goes well for any kind of dust.
Fair enough.
Yeah. A potentially habitable planet has been discovered orbiting Tau Ceti, which is a star about 12 light years away. They've actually found several planets that have the potential of being habitable. And they tend to be around 2 to 6 times larger than Earth. One of them's actually 5 times the mass of Earth. But this particular planet that is really getting the attention appears to be right in the Goldilocks zone. And that's all we've got on that.
Well, yeah, we can just add that to a long list of planets that have been found so far.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really looking like life probably isn't that special. Mm-mm. On Earth here.
Or just planets in general. That's definitely not special.
Yeah.
I think after this one, exoplanets will no longer be noteworthy. Until we find one with life on it, or find one that we're going to go send a spacecraft to. Yeah, they're no longer that cool. I doubt we'll be talking about any for a while. And that's it for science. Now we get to talk about really fun stuff.
Oh, lovely. Yes, yes.
All right, so I'm sure by now you've all heard about the latest gang rape in Delhi, India. And don't need to go into the big details on it, but there's actually been some flack that I've seen about it. Just because people that are pissed off that people are finally starting to care about this. But it was a situation that really broke the callus of Indian society. And there's two critical factors in that. The woman was middle class, and she was out walking with her boyfriend. So she wasn't alone.
Neither of which point should matter, but to them.
Correct.
Yes.
It shouldn't, but it broke their misconceptions that it only happens to the poor, so it doesn't matter. Or these women would be safer if they weren't going out alone. Well, apparently not. Obviously not. So what they're running into is, you know, there have been massive protests about this. There have been government crackdowns on the protests. They've been so bad. This has been all over the press, not only in India, but worldwide. And now the lawyers at the court in Delhi that are supposed to be defending the accused are refusing.
That is all, awesome.
All 2,500 advocates registered at that court have decided to, according to the article in the Hindustan Times, stay away to ensure speedy justice, meaning the government would have to appoint lawyers for the defendants. other lawyers are also confirming this boycott. It's awesome. So far, only 5 men are expecting to face charges, including rape, murder, and kidnapping. There's another suspect that's thought to be 17 years old, so he'll probably go to a juvenile court. But this is going to change things.
It's about damn time.
It is. It really is. Now, it's sad that it takes something like this to change things, but that's the way things are. That's the way human psychology works. It has to be somebody that isn't thought of as being at risk to run into that problem. It's sad, but it's true. But it's nice that it's actually going to trial. They're actually expecting that the prosecutors are going to be seeking the death penalty.
And attorneys to actually see them standing up. You know, everybody thinks of attorneys as like ambulance chasers or, you know, defending the undefendable. But, well, that's awesome to see all these people saying no. We fuck that. We don't want to touch these guys.
Yeah. Because with the amount of attention this one's gotten, who in their right mind would want to be the attorney defending that?
Hey,
that would
say that about could say that about all of OJ's attorneys.
True.
And they're all still making money.
Yeah. Now, it's kind of on the flip side with this. It is kind of sad that the attorneys are all boycotting because you can't have an effective legal system without, you know, without a defense. That's a very crucial aspect.
Granted, but the court will just appoint one of those 2,500 attorneys.
Yeah.
So it'll just take an extra few days to get somebody rounded up for that.
And that one will have the deniability of having refused and just being forced to by court order.
Be like, hey, I didn't want this shit.
Yeah.
These guys fucked. These guys are fucked. We didn't want this. Yeah. So, ooh.
But it's definitely nice to see that they're going to be facing justice, and hopefully rape will be taken seriously now in India. That would be a definite nice step in the right direction. All right.
Yeah.
Next up, the Miami-Dade County Commission has decided, this was in a vote 8-3, to reinstate prayers at their meetings. Now, they did away with prayers in 2004, and they went to just having a moment of silence. But after 18 months of lobbying by the Christian Family Coalition, they decided to go ahead and go back to discriminating against the non-religious.
I'm actually kind of surprised that Miami-Dade didn't have a prayer all this time. But it's good to see that the ACLU is about to, take them to court.
Yeah. It's...
Florida, I always think of as really old people or really young people. And generally very religious. So I'm kind of surprised that it's there isn't more prayer down there.
Well, people tend to be a lot less religious in metropolitan areas.
Sure.
And the
but it seems like that's kind of like the retirement home for
that's further north. That's really not Miami.
Okay. The bill's sponsor, instead of having like a county clerk compile a database of local religious leaders, they'll just have the commissioners rotate choosing someone or lead the prayer themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll save everybody like $26,000. So, you know, that prayer will actually save you money.
Save them money in terms of what it would cost if they were actually doing it. Going to be doing the horrible thing, the better way.
I just like the way that they're selling it, like, you know, hey, we're saving you money here, come on.
Yeah.
Have a prayer, we'll save you $26,000 if we do it, come on.
Yeah.
You fuck. Yeah, a moment of silence, come on, what's wrong with that? Fine, you want it, fine.
Now I've got a novel idea. If you want a moment of silence, take that on your drive in. If you want to pray before you go to the meeting.
Yeah, before that gavel hits the little wood block thing.
Yeah, or before you leave your house, even.
Sure.
That the time spent for the meeting, and granted, this prayer they've decided to reinstate is going to be before the gavel, but it's pointless. It is completely pointless. If you want to have government do its job, use the time to do the job of government, period.
All right. People complain about their government being ineffective and not doing stuff. This is taking away from that time that where they could be not doing stuff.
Yeah. And they wasted time discussing the ordinance or whatever the resolution, discussing the resolution. They wasted time discussing the resolution and voting on it. And now they're going to be wasting time fighting it in court.
Yeah. Wasting your money, too.
This is the 21st century. Nobody should be instating prayers in government bodies in the 21st century. It's ridiculous. Just when you start to think the world might be getting better, no, it really isn't. It's just mind-boggling sometimes.
There's some really stupid shit out there.
Yeah.
All right,
speaking of stupid shit.
I actually kind of like this one.
Oh, yeah. Google has been working on the Dead Sea Scrolls digital project, and they've got a lot of documents digitized and available on the website, which we've got links to the article about it and the actual archive itself in the show notes. But yeah, digital copies of the Dead Sea Scrolls. These date back to, in some cases, 100 BCE. It does include some Old Testament apocryphal texts, like the Apocryphon of Daniel. The text is dated to 50 to 1 BCE, at least for this particular manuscript of it. The Book of War, detailing an apocalyptic 40-year battle between the forces of good and evil. Oh, man, that'd make a fun read.
Make a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
You could put that right up in the science fiction section where it belongs.
From 134 CE, they've got some legal documents.
Oh, that'd be kind of cool.
And so I was just looking at the featured scrolls, but they've got the full archive available. Different languages you can look at them in. Oh, that is cool. This is just too cool. Some of these are just little tiny fragments with a couple letters on them, but oh, god damn. Some of these are much more substantial. Might need to brush up on my Greek and take a look. Oh, very, very cool. I'm going to stop just rambling about it. So yeah, go check it out. And finally for news, we have the man in the red Prada slippers wearing a dress, pulling up a giant red herring. Pope Benedict, in his Christmas Eve address, took the time to denounce gay marriage, claiming that it destroys the essence of the human creature. He's claiming that gay marriage, abortion, and euthanasia are a threat to world peace.
I've always felt that way about the euthanasia.
That it's a threat to world peace?
Definitely. They multiply way too quick.
Euthanasias?
The euthanasia. Doesn't China have that whole one-child policy? They know what's up.
Oh, man. Yeah. So, yeah, the Pope was being his normal douchey popiness.
Yeah, but this is his Christmas Mass, too. I mean, come on.
Well, traditionally, the Christmas Mass is all about world peace.
Yeah.
And praying for peace.
And he's taking time out of his day to be a dick.
Yeah. Those issues have absolutely nothing to do with world peace. Nothing to do with peace in this world. You know what does have something to do with peace? Religion. Or getting in the way of peace, at least.
Kind of like his friend in Nigeria that we talked about last show, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about destroying the human nature? This is a guy who has spent his career protecting pedophile priests and at least pretending to be celibate. You don't think that goes against human nature?
And sure, he was a kid, but I'm just going to poison the well a little bit more. Wasn't he a Hitler youth?
Yes, he was.
Just putting that out there.
there's one real gem from here. So one statement the Pope made was, when freedom to be creative becomes the freedom to create oneself, then necessarily the maker himself is denied, and ultimately man too is stripped of his dignity as a creature of God, claiming that you are who you are when you're born, and made more direct statements about that, but that you are who you are when you're born, and that you shouldn't do anything to change that. Forgetting the fact that, yeah, he's right about one thing. You are who you are when you're born, and there's a lot of people that are born gay.
I won't even talk about the, 150 different species that have been identified to have homosexual males and females in their ranks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's definitely not in nature. Yeah. Right.
And, although the red slippers and dress, though.
Well, come on. Man, those are little red slippers, aren't they?
Uh-huh.
I wonder if he can knock his heels together 3 times.
And I'm pretty sure they're Prada. I think I've heard before that he wears very expensive Prada slippers.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
But didn't he ever hear that you're not supposed to wear white after Labor Day?
Yeah, I think that's only for women.
Really?
Nah, I don't know. But yeah, there's when does that stop?
I mean, I think it's
every day is technically after Labor Day.
I think Memorial Day. I think Memorial Day to Labor Day, it's okay because it's hot and summertime and wear white linen clothing or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
If you know, please let us know. Or don't. All right. Now for it's time for music. And then right after that, we'll be jumping into the interview with Daryl Ray. So for music, we have Josh Woodward from Songs for the People Who Like Things, called Golden Sunrise.
We're sheltered from the sunlight in the shade beneath the tree. We hide behind the shadows like an orphaned refugee. The apple tree of knowledge shed its fruit along the way. Injury is fading, but the hunger is here to stay until the day when there's no memory of what we used to be. Sun engulfs the sky, the brightness overwhelming to the unadjusted eye. We're taught to follow blindly like there's nothing here to see. A slave to some philosophy will somehow make you free, and you will be so gladly handcuffed in light and from. Question is a sin. Is there no remedy for the state that we are in? With knowledge on a leash, it's like a terminal disease, and we won't be awake to see that we are fading out.
Yeah, that was Golden Sunrise by Josh Woodward, and the song is licensed Creative Commons by, and the lyrics are just really cool. Check out the website, buy the song, buy some other his work. Take a look at the lyrics here. A couple of really cool lines, like, we're taught to follow blindly, like there's nothing here to see. A slave to some philosophy will somehow make you free.
I was quite impressed. I like that song a lot better than I thought I would. I just read the lyrics, but it's got a good sound.
Yeah.
So, now, yeah. All right. Yeah. Go give that guy some money.
Joining us now is Dr. Daryl Ray. Dr. Ray is a organizational psychologist who's also done counseling and clinical psychology. He holds a doctorate in psychology, an MA in religion, and a BA in sociology and anthropology. He's the founder of Recovering from Religion and the author of The God Virus and Sex and God. And you can see him at the Northwest Freethought Conference coming up in April in Portland. Dr. Ray, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. I'm looking forward to the conference, too.
Yes, that will be a blast.
Yeah.
Definitely. Looking forward to joining you there.
Yeah.
It will probably be the most fun at the bar afterwards of all of them that I've been to, at least.
Oh, okay. Well, that's where I have most of my fun, at the bar.
No, I mean, it'll be more fun because you're going to be there.
Oh. Okay, that'll be fun, too.
Nice. Now I can add you and Hemet to that list of getting people drunk at conferences.
You know, I don't get drunk. I just don't. I've been drunk once in my whole life, and I know people look at me and think I'm weird or something, but
no.
I just like to be. I don't mind drinking. I just don't get drunk. I was drunk one time. I was going. I was at a conference, 10 days training conference, and about halfway through, I had a cold, and I took some antihistamine and I went to this party, and they were all drinking wine and beer and stuff, and I had 2 glasses of wine, and that knocked me on my keister with the antihistamine. I didn't think about alcohol mixing with the antihistamines. Man, I had a major hangover the next day. That taught me why I don't want to drink, get drunken.
Oh, I found that 3 beers and 2 Benadryl.
Oh
man. I've got allergies, so periodically I have to pop some Benadryl, and if I wash it down with beer, I get really wasted fast.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you. I don't need it.
All right. So, Daryl, you want to talk to us about your books that you have?
Well, I've actually got 4 books, but you don't want to hear me talk about the first two because they're on organizational psychology, which is kind of a dry subject. Kind of interesting to me, but dry for everybody else. And but having written those 2 books back in the 90s, 2001 is when my second book came out, I was pretty I really enjoyed writing a lot. And I read Richard Dawkins and just blew my mind when I read his Viruses of the Mind essay. And I realized that he's a biologist, and then Daniel Dennett's a philosopher, and, you know, all the others. Sam Harris is kind of a neuro guy, and Christopher Hitchens, of course, is a journalist. But nobody's a psychologist, and nobody was looking at this issue of religion and the psychology of religion from an atheist perspective, from a psychological perspective, and a scientific perspective. So that's what led me to really get into writing The God Virus, and I wrote those first 3 chapters of that book, sent them off to my best friend, who's the kind of guy that'll tell me if I'm full of shit, and he'll do it in 3 nanoseconds too. He's never been, you know, shy about letting me know I'm barking up the wrong tree. But he looked at those 3 chapters and immediately got back to me and said, "Wow, I've never read anything like this before, and keep writing." So that gave me the encouragement to I was on to something. And you know, you don't just write a book; you really refine it and edit it and research it and all. But I'm very pleased with it. It came out in 2009, and it just sells consistently, high seller. It stays high rated on Amazon. And it's the nice thing about it is I think what The God Virus has done, it's given people. I mean, you can read Dawkins. I don't ever think I'm putting Dawkins down. I love the guy. I love what he's done, and I love his work. But you know, there's no handles. It's hard to get a hold of Hitchens or Dawkins and have a handle to go talk to your neighbor about, or to talk to your atheist best friend or whatever. And I think what I was seeking in The God Virus was to give people a conceptual framework that they can now turn around and talk back to the religionists, and they could talk to their co-atheists or freethinkers. And this, you know, the framework of a virus really, really helps, among other things, you know, because I talk a lot in The God Virus about hypnosis, the trained hypnotist, and how hypnosis is so key. It's a key ingredient to all major religious ritual, and it's how they infect you with these crazy ideas that You know, on the surface, they're crazy if they came from somebody else's religion, but from my religion, no, they're not crazy. So that was kind of the inspiration for him.
Well, not only that, but looking at it as an infection is a lot less insulting than you're delusional.
Yeah.
Or that this thing you base your life off of poisons everything.
Yeah.
No, you're sick. That's not insulting. That's you have a problem and we can help you with it.
Well, most religionists don't like me using the word infection either, but I do think it's a little less, not much, a little less insulting to them. But you can't talk about infection in objective ways. You can talk to a Baptist and say, boy, you can talk about to a Baptist about a Mormon. And you could say, wow, they're really infected with the Mormon religion, and the Baptist will agree with you. Or you could talk to a Catholic about, wow, that other person's really infected with Islam, and they will agree with you. So that's a step in the right direction right there. When you start using the terminology of infection, it's only another step or two till they start applying it to themselves. Well, maybe I'm infected too.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been, that's the metaphor, I think, that's really... I think a lot of times for us to look at ourselves, to examine our own behavior and our own assumptions and beliefs, we have to have a portal or a key. I don't have a good name for it, but we have to have a framework in which to do that. And if you don't have that framework, then yeah, it's a nice book to read. But I'm not satisfied with writing a nice book. I want people to walk away from reading The God Virus and think, dang, I am infected. And I do need to reexamine my thinking, and I do need to understand how I got this in my head. And that's, you know, that's me. That's the psychologist in me. I'm not satisfied with just writing. I want to reach out to people and grab them by the throat and say, look at yourself. Look at your behavior. Where'd you get these crazy ideas? And what are you going to do about it? Because it's hurting you and it's hurting other people. And then I think that's. Hey, can't do anything else in the world. That's a pretty good thing to do. Just get people to re-examine their basic assumptions.
Oh, for sure.
That's one of the hardest things to get people to do is to get introspective on themselves.
It really is. But it's worth every minute of work when somebody emails me and said, my brother-in-law gave me this book and I'm no longer in religion anymore or something like that. And that just makes my day to have people email me like that or come up with me conference and say that they've really thought about it and they've been able to now. I think one of the things I like that I've seen happen is how it's because I do write about parenting and I write about relationships and marriage in The God Virus. And I have people tell me that those concepts help them talk with their religious spouse in more respectful ways or help them talk to their children about the religion that's constantly being crammed down people's kids' throats, school and places, you know. So the framework is a good framework for talking to other people. And I try to write it in a respectful way. I even say up front, if you might even be a little religious, but the book's still readable for people who might have some ideas about religion or spirituality. It will not be readable for a Baptist. I'll guarantee that. I spare nobody when it comes to those religions or those cults. So that was The God Virus, and then chapter 5 of The God Virus just seemed to grab people. They really liked that chapter, and it's called Sex and the God Virus. And
go figure.
Yeah, applies to all of us. And when I did my talks, I'd always do a hypnosis component to my talks, and that always went over well. People want to understand what hypnosis is all about. Does it work or does it not work? You know, all that stuff. But the other component I did was demonstrate the way that music, for example, works in a church and all that sort of stuff to hypnotize people. And that's always really interesting. But the other second thing that was most interesting, or at least the one I got the most responses from people on, was when I started talking about sex. And that seemed to grab people too. And that's chapter 5. Was what inspired me to think about, well, maybe I should go the next step and write a book about sex. I've always been interested in sex, and I wanted to write about sex someday. I just never realized this would be the way I would be doing it. I thought I'd write, you know, a self-help book for sex or something. Turned out I did write a self-help book for sex. It just wasn't what I thought it was going to be. So sex, it's two-thirds of the book helps you understand the last third. I wrote this one as very much in the self-help, but in a not in a self-help knee-jerk way. I hate self-help books, actually. So erase what I just said. I did not use the word self-help. I wrote this book so people could examine their assumptions and beliefs and ideas about themselves, about their bodies, about their sexuality, about other people's sexuality, about their culture's sexuality. And to that end, I really explore that through the whole first two thirds of the book. And then the last five chapters I have done, each of those chapters tries to challenge people to really rethink the internal, to look inside themselves. The first two thirds of the book is looking at other cultures, looking at other people, looking at how we develop sexuality, looking at what different kinds of sexuality there are, and the biology. There's just all sorts of things, the genetics, the epigenetics. There's just so much that goes into sexuality. And what I found is most atheists don't have a clue. I mean, secularists, we're pretty well educated generally, but we're not very well educated around human sexuality. At least that's been my observation. So
you're trying to fix that.
I am going to fix that. Yeah. I mean, funny, we know everybody else's religion. I mean, I hardly know any atheists that don't know everybody else's religion better than they know it themselves. But so we're really well-read in that area. What we're not so well-read and versed in is something that's even closer to us, and that's our bodies and our sexuality, which, you know, every cell in your body is sexual. It's got an XX or an XY chromosome in it or some other variation, and you are a sexual creature. So to not understand that, you know, it's, I think, dangerous even. And I've seen a lot of secularists, they're not only not educated about human sexuality, but they continue to carry assumptions, Christian assumptions, religious assumptions in their heads and beliefs, structures. I just really think we need to, in my recent talks, I've got a new talk I've been given the last 3 or 4 months called The Shame of It All. And the main thesis is to the audience is I'm not a Christian and I'm not going to act like a Christian. And I see a heck of a lot of atheists acting like Christians. And you got to ask, if you're an atheist, why do you believe you have to act like a Christian? Why do you have to condemn other people, for example, for their sexual preferences? Why do you have to make assumptions about things like masturbation or pornography? And we just see that the secular community has not really examined these religious taboos and religious ideas and come to their own conclusions about, you know, about all these areas that religion says you can't do. You know, premarital sex, extramarital sex, non-monogamous sex, polyamory, just thing after thing after thing you can name that we can make up our own minds. We don't have any God looking over our shoulder. And like I say in the book, you know, if you're married and you get in bed with your spouse, you're having a threesome with Jesus. That's just, Jesus is always watching you. That was a joke, guys.
Oh,
I was about to say, some people are into that.
Mm-hmm. Hey, if that floats your boat.
Well, you guys are a tough audience. I usually get.
I thought you were on a roll. I wasn't going to stop you. I wanted to laugh, but. Ooh. Yeah.
20 chapters deal with all sorts of stuff. And I think that probably one of the more important parts of those last five chapters is dealing with things like jealousy. And what does jealousy really mean, and breaking it down so that, because I think people have huge assumptions and beliefs around jealousy, and it really impacts their behavior and their relationships in negative ways. So yeah. I try to reframe jealousy and give people some new ways to look at it.
Nice. So, I would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well,
yes, please.
When somebody says they're jealous, that tells you zero about what's really going on between their ears. On the other hand, if somebody says, I feel threatened by your golf buddies because you guys talk about things that I'm afraid of what you're talking about. That is a concrete thing to be discussed. And it's quite different than just saying I'm jealous. If I say, you know, I'm jealous of you having another girlfriend. What does that really say? Does it say, I'm jealous that you having a sexual relationship with another person may mean you'll desert me, that you'll abandon me? That abandonment, fear of abandonment, is a legitimate emotional concern. So let's talk about fear of abandonment. Don't use the word jealousy. When you start breaking jealousy down into its component parts, you really don't need the word anymore. What you need is a more precise language to describe the emotional experience that you're having between your own ears. And I could talk to you about your emotional experience with precision I can ask, well, you know, what are you afraid of? I have a girlfriend. What are you afraid of if I'm going out with playing golf? And we can deal with fears. Fears are something you can talk about. You can negotiate about. You can make decisions around. You can change behavior around. But couldn't you do that with just the word jealousy? I mean, it tells you nothing.
Yeah,
so
that's a good point.
I've really been pushing the idea, and I push it hard in the book, that we really need to get rid of this idea of jealousy. Just throw the word out. It doesn't add anything to the conversation, and it usually gets people's defenses up. If I say I'm jealous of you, X, Y, or Z, you're already defensive. Well, partly the reason you're going to get defensive is because you don't know what the hell I'm talking about. If, on the other hand, I come up to you and say, you play golf 3 times a week, is a lot of money out of our pockets, and I can't buy shoes for the kids, that's something we can talk about. We can negotiate about. We can make decisions about. And we don't even need to use the word jealous of your golf buddies or whatever, you know, whatever it is. So what I'm trying to teach people and have them think about it in the book is to be more precise in your language and how you describe your own emotional experiences. And of course, it's called Second God, that's the name of the book, and recognize that you got a lot of these assumptions from your religious training. And even if you were not raised religious, you were raised in a religiously polluted culture. Just being in the gym class, for example, you know, when I was in eighth grade, which is a few years ago, when I was in eighth grade, you know, you go in here and take a shower and the kids would make fun of each other. You know, you're nude and they're making fun of each other. Well, that's what teenage boys do. But there's some messages in there. For example, you know, you go to the urinal and you'd pee and then somebody say, hey, you shook it more than 3 times. You must be a homo. And I mean, people would say that. Have you guys ever heard that before?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Right. Now, where did people get that idea?
Not a clue.
From religion.
It absolutely comes from religion, yeah. Because religion says masturbation is wrong and you're going to hell for it and all that sort of stuff. I mean, the Mormons even give 12-year-old boys a handout. I reprinted about a quarter of the handout in the book. It's called Don't Tamper with the Factory. Pamphlet dedicated to telling boys not to masturbate, as if that's going to happen. And then in the entire pamphlet, it doesn't mention the word sex, doesn't mention the word masturbation, doesn't mention the word penis, nothing. Everything is used metaphorically. How do you talk about 4 or 5 pages, single space type, about masturbation and never use any sexual terms at all? What they do is say, well, it's a little factory between your legs and you don't want to touch it. It'll go crazy on you. 12-year-old girl, every 12-year-old boy gets this lesson. Now, here's the kicker. The guy in charge of doing this, and it is a guy, is the bishop. In other words, Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was a bishop in that church, and that's the level at which he was actually responsible for setting 12-year-old boys down, handing them this thing and talking to them about masturbating. And you cannot get a temple recommend. You can't get into the temple if you admit to masturbating. So, man, I would have never made it.
Well, growing up in the Adventist church, the Adventists are against masturbation. But the funny thing was, they talked about it so much in the 80s that by the time they would have been talking to me about it in the 90s, nobody was talking about it anymore. They'd kind of overdone it, and they just kind of started ignoring it, assuming everybody knew. I didn't know it was a problem until like my senior year of high school.
Oops.
And I never heard it from anybody in any kind of an official capacity.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I'd only heard about it from friends and classmates who they'd heard about it from their families. And yeah, never heard about it in any kind of official capacity.
Right, because people never grow up.
Yeah, so I just went on jerking off all the way through.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, in our survey, we found that Mormons were number one in guilt, but Seventh-day Adventists were right behind them. I mean, 10th behind them. And Jehovah's Witnesses and Pentecostals, all four of those groups were really, really high in sexual guilt. So they must have been teaching something at Adventist schools. Or
Well, one thing with all four of those religious groups is they are very separate from the rest of society.
Yeah.
And so you've got your own culture, your own subculture, and everything is completely confined within that.
Yep.
And so it creates a much larger, much more opportunity for guilt and shaming because everybody sees what everybody does.
Yeah, right.
You know, I've got stories that I shared one with you when your survey was first published, that would have been perfect to go into your book, or would be awesome to share on a blog or podcast. But because of how confined that culture is, if I were to share any details of it publicly, it would get back to the person that was the other person that was involved.
Yeah.
And everybody would know.
Uh-huh. Well, those very isolated groups are they're cults. There's no getting around it. They're cults. That's a key component is sexual shame. And I do spend about a chapter in the book talking about sexual shame and how that works and why sexual shame is a founding, you know, a foundational concept for all the major religions on the planet. You know, without sexual shame, you don't have a religion. I mean, imagine the Pope waking up one day and said, "Wow, I had a great wet dream last night." It's illegal in the Catholic Church. I don't think we're going to see that. So it's that need to create shame and guilt, or that technique. It's a technique. You know, you make people feel really shamed and guilty about something they're going to do anyway. I mean, even if they'd have told you, let's say they followed their practice and taught you from the time you're 12 years old that you shouldn't be masturbating. Let me guess, would you have masturbated anyway?
Yeah.
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 It wouldn't have slowed me down a bit.
But you'd have felt guilty as hell afterwards. Just oh, yeah.
There was a certain point in college
I would have kept feeling guilty 4 or 5 times a day.
There was a point in college where I decided I needed to stop masturbating. And the longest I went, I think, was 45 days.
Oh, my gosh.
Why?
Because I believed it to be wrong. And I was feeling guilty when I do it. So I finally stopped. And, yeah, I made it 45 days. And it was – those were not fun days.
If you're feeling guilty during, you're watching the wrong kind of porn, man.
Oh, I never felt guilty during.
Okay.
Afterwards. Well, that works, and it makes you, but then you have to go back to the place you learned the guilt. So religion gives you this disease, and then it offers you a false cure. And in the God virus, I call this the guilt cycle. And the guilt cycle always brings you back to the place that you learned the guilt in the first place. So you can't get forgiveness for having masturbated unless you read your Bible, go to Sunday school, do confession, or whatever your particular religion requires to get absolution from that sin of having masturbated. It's an insidious process, but it works beautifully because you're going to masturbate anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Going to be premarital sex anyway. All it's trying to do is make you feel guilty about what you're going to do anyway. And then, of course, that brings you back for forgiveness. Beautiful technique.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they sell the problem and you get to buy the cure.
Yeah.
Horrible.
So you were feeling quite guilty as a result, and this happened quite late because you didn't even know it was bad.
Yeah.
So they were able to inculcate that guilt in you actually at a pretty late stage.
It wasn't while I was in college, a fellow student talking about, actually it was during Week of Prayer. So this was before the entire student body at what was then called Walla Walla College. Now it's Walla Walla University. And, you know, 1,000 people present listening to this as he's talking about his porn addiction, which really just means average man, but his porn addiction. And I listened to that and it kind of got to me a while later, but we were all deep enough in that we were spreading that shame with each other.
But you know, I do a lot of biology in the book to deal with to help explain things like, why do we masturbate? Masturbation is almost a biological imperative. You said you had 45 days. That's a long time for a male.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know people, you know, some people can turn their sexuality off, like priests, some priests, not all, obviously. So I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's very difficult. How do you turn off your entire body? And that's what you're doing. But so what we know,
I couldn't turn off my body, so I started having wet dreams again.
Yeah, there you go. And it's going to come out one way or the other, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? Change sheets more often.
And in a way that is less healthy for the prostate.
Yeah, right. And yeah.
Physically unhealthy, increasing your risk of cancer.
Yeah, right.
That's pretty messed up.
Man, why wouldn't I have known that when I was a kid? Why couldn't I have told my mom that?
Well, I think atheist moms should know all about this.
You don't want me getting cancer, Mom.
Yeah.
Man.
Oh. Stills does 2 things. It keeps the pipes clean and keeps the inventory fresh. Because a sperm only lasts about 5 days, and then they start losing their potency.
Mm-hmm.
terms of just reproduction, you want to have the ripest, most powerful sperm possible. And if you've gone 45 days without masturbating, man, you got old men in your testicles. You got to get rid of that and keep it flowing. You got to keep the pipes clean, yeah. Keep being fresh.
Keep it so the swimmers are still swimming.
That's right, right. And it is, does almost equally good stuff for females. Female masturbation is great for keeping the vaginal lining and all healthy, and it keeps sexual response. I tell when I do my talks, I'm amazed at women that don't feel ashamed of masturbating. I think women are even more ashamed of masturbating than men in some cases. And, you know, I've been, as a clinical psychologist, I've had people in my office and they were just scared to death to masturbate, and they're having marital problems or having sexual problems. And the question I have to ask is, you want your husband to give you an orgasm, but you don't know how to give yourself an orgasm. Now, how is that going to work? And they've never thought of it that way. Masturbation is really the way you get in touch with your own body and your own mind. And it's true for women. And it's true for men. And I think we should be, as atheists, we should be out there about this. And because here's the key. As far as I'm concerned, you can debate whether God exists all day long. You're not going to get anywhere. But when you say to a minister, I masturbate, don't you? He could do one of two things. He can lie to your face, or he can tell the truth. If he lies to you, I mean, you know he's a male. He's probably as much as you are, but he's denying it. And if he tells the truth, he's just shown that he can't do what he's telling everybody else to do. So you got him either way. And that's just the way all of sexuality works. Religion does not want you to talk about sexuality. It does not want you to talk about sex. It does not want you to learn the facts of life. Because if it can keep you in the dark, then it can keep you guilty. But the minute you realize that preacher had three girlfriends before he got married, one of them he got pregnant, probably. His wife had a boyfriend or two on the side before she got married. She didn't use condoms. You know, you can just find all sorts. My first wife went to a Bible college, so I know this works. I know it. They were having more sex in that Bible college than you can imagine, and yet they had a curfew. You had to be in on 10 o'clock on weeknights and 11 o'clock on weekend nights. And, man, they made them dress real puritanical. But yet, every semester, several girls would disappear from the campus and never come back. And you never know why they decided not to come back the next semester, because they were pregnant. And it happened over and over again. So that's the key. And that's what I've really been trying to get out in the free thought community, is let's start talking openly about sex and sexuality. Let's get comfortable with our sexuality. And I take the lead from the gay community, because the gay community is right out there. And I love that about the gay community. They are no longer ashamed of who they are and what they are. And I love that. I think that's the courage. They've gained enough courage to get out there and not let the hetero community intimidate them any longer. And as a result, seeing all sorts of amazing changes in the United States around gay marriage, for example, and, you know, civil rights for gays and stuff. Well, the same thing is true with heterosexuality, with any kind of sexuality, with respect to churches and religion. If we start being open and say, you know, to Sunday school teachers or to ministers or to just our religious neighbor, talk openly about our sexuality, it is a direct challenge to their crazy ideas. But and it's a very interesting challenge, because they really can't argue with it too much, because they don't even want to talk about it. They want to get back home. They want to get you out of their church or whatever, because the minute you start saying, what's wrong with masturbation? I do it. You know, if you leave it in the intellectual framework, if I was on this radio program, right, or this podcast right now, and I said, guys, there's nothing wrong with masturbation, that's one kind of statement. But when I say there's nothing wrong with masturbation and I do it, that adds a whole new layer of information that cannot, you know, really cannot be refuted. And I'm still alive. I'm doing quite well. I haven't had any major sexual problems in my life. So what's the problem with this? If that's our attitude, we really do have an opportunity to challenge religionists in ways that no God debate will ever do. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Oh, yeah.
I think it makes a bunch of sense. I would really wish to see us doing more of that.
Would make for some wonderful conversations, too.
Yeah, in my talks, I try to give my audience as examples, and I certainly do in the book. You know, things like asking if you're in a conversation with a religious person, and you can get them towards, you can change the subject in some way or push it towards sex and sexuality. You can say, "Well, now your minister is against your minister is against premarital sex, right?" And they'll say, "Whoa, yes, and you are too, right?" "Yes, right." So that means never had premarital sex. He never had sex before he got married, and neither did you. Is that is that a true statement? Will you tell me that with a straight face? And of course, they'll say, "Well, I did, but I can't say about my minister, but I believe he didn't either." Well, then the next thing you say is, "Do you realize that since 1950s, we've got evidence that 95% of all the people in the United States have had premarital sex, and you and your minister are the only two that haven't?" I mean, there's way that's humorous and challenging. I think you're going to get a hell of a lot farther with that kind of conversation than you are to say, "Well, you know, your Jesus is an idiot," which, you know, I believe Jesus is an idiot, but that's not going to get you very far in talking to people. But even if that person goes home denying that they had premarital sex or denying that they masturbate and denying that their minister does, I'd also ask, "Does your minister masturbate?" ask, "What's wrong with it? You know, does your priest masturbate? Do you think your nuns masturbate?" And even if they deny it, they're still going to go home and think about it and masturbate. And think about that girlfriend or boyfriend they had before they got married. And so you have just put a whole thought process in their head that is absolutely forbidden in their religious world.
Quite probably one of the worst mental pictures ever of thinking about their priest or pastor masturbating. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you never know.
That's usually not that kind of compromising position. That's usually not something you want to think about your religious leader doing.
You're right. And
unless you're attracted to your religious leader.
But still, it's that whole, you know, not taking that frontal approach and kind of sneaking around to the back door and like getting that little virus in their head.
Right, exactly. I mean, we're just giving them some ideas that their religion does not allow. And I really think they will debate you all day long about, you know, the validity of the Bible and whether God exists, whether Jesus was a real person. That's okay. Go ahead and debate them all you want. But ask, did Jesus masturbate? Very sexually active adolescent? You know, I think those are legitimate questions to start asking. I dedicate a whole chapter in the book to the question, where are the women in the Bible? So you look in the New Testament, there are very, very few women in the New Testament. There's not that many in the Old Testament either, but there's few women. And I have to ask the question, where are the women? Why did the women disappear? I mean, Paul says he wasn't married, but nobody gets to be in the position that Paul was without being married back then. Maybe he was a widower. We don't know. He had a thorn in his side, he said. Well, I think he masturbated too much. Or a girlfriend on the side. I don't know. But he wasn't telling us the truth. And when you look at the 12 apostles, what do you think? What would you think if you saw a guy walking around Galilee with 12 guys following him? He's at least somewhat gay. Two apostles were married, or at least it says. But what about the other 10? And where are the wives that there were two Peter was married. Now, Peter's the guy that everybody followed now as Pope. Peter's the first Pope, but he was married. And if you're married and you're Jewish, well, first of all, you could not be a 30-year-old man in Israel at that time and not be married. It was just almost impossible. And if you're married, you're going to have kids because Jews back then were prolific at having kids. Not much anymore, but they used to be. And of course, Orthodox still are. So the question is, where is Peter's wife? Where are all those kids that Peter had and all the other apostles? You got 12 apostles. If they all had an average of 5 kids, that's a hell of a lot of kids running around. And there's a hell of a lot of grandkids running around. And not one of them made it into the New Testament. That's pretty interesting, I think. It's a question nobody's ever asked. Richard Carrier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, that particular chapter, I wanted to make sure I was on solid ground. I really respect Richard Carrier. So I sent that chapter off to him and said, "Richard, look at this. I want to see what you think." And he basically comes back to me and said, "Shit, I've never thought of that either." And it is a very interesting question. What happened to all the women?
Hmm.
Well, here's what happened to all the women. They edited them out. I mean, there are gospels. We know there's a gospel of Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
We have a gospel of Thomas that has women in it. They just got rid of the women. Why would you get rid of women? because women are sexual creatures. And if an apostle was married, that means he was in a sexual creature. Christianity is an asexual religion, and it was from very, very early on. It's a patriarchal religion, and it's an asexual religion, which means it tries to really, really downplay sex as only for procreation. And early in Christianity, they even tried to tell you not to even get married. Mm-hmm. Paul said, don't get married. Better to marry than burn. Well, of course, that doesn't work too well after 50 or 60 years, and this guy hadn't come back yet. So you got to change your views on it a little bit. But if you read the Antinicene fathers like Origen or Tertullian, those guys were assholes. They were so misogynistic. They hated women. I quote Tertullian, in the book. The guy basically says, "Women, you're the cause of the entire world's problems because you convinced Adam into eating the apple." And that was his attitude. Can you imagine being that guy's wife? So,
well, at that point, there was still a really strong ascetic bent in Christianity. And the key ascetic principle was to deny any and all sexuality.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So he wouldn't have had a wife.
Well, it's fairly easy to see that early Christians were really against sex and any kind of romantic feelings. I mean, God, he didn't even want to have sex. He barely even stuck the tip in. You know, poor Mary, she didn't get any. Still a virgin.
Well, are you guys familiar with the Antinicene fathers? Do you know what that
is? Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, if you read any of the Antinicene fathers, you see nothing but misogyny and anti-sexual ideas. You're absolutely right. It was the first 300 years were just massively focused on anti-sexual ideas. But here's what I try to say in the book is that those men did marry. They were Jews. They weren't ascetics. They don't make a claim to be ascetics. Mm-hmm. And maybe Jesus might have been an Essene. Some people, you know, theorize that if he really existed. But, you know, there's traditions that say Jesus was married. I mean, there were traditions on 500 years after his death that claimed he had a wife. And, you know, the Mormons say he had three wives. And he brought them over to the United States and did whatever he did over here, I guess. I don't know. But Jesus had three wives, according to the Mormons. So it's hard to believe that the 12 apostles, didn't have wives. It is easy to understand why they would want to eliminate them. Because if you're anti-sex, then you don't want your heroes, the founders of your church, to be seen as sexual beings. So they can't have had wives. So we never talk about this. Can't have had children. Never put those in the book. Certainly don't have grandchildren. Now, we actually have an experiment, and it's happened right here within living memory, with the Mormons. You can see how religions start, develop, grow, and some of the things that happen to them. What happens when the religious leader has wives and children? Then you have wives and children making a claim to his legacy against the elders and people really built the church.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have the followers of Jesus and their children making a claim against people who were not descendants. And we saw that in Joseph Smith and Brigham Young.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Joseph Smith died, his son, who was still pretty young, was supposed to take over from him, but Brigham Young didn't do that. Brigham Young took him out to Salt Lake City. So we had a split, and that split exists today. The church, I forget, they just changed their name.
The FLDS, that's the one.
No.
No, that's a different split.
Here in Kansas, the FLDS is later. One here in Kansas City is called, used to be called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, RLS. And they've changed their name recently. But anyway, that was the split that came off of Joseph Smith's son. So you had two Mormons. They both used the Book of Mormon, and they have since the beginning. But you have that problem. Now, Muhammad had the same problem because Muhammad's wives, they had children. Well, there's a tradition that goes down through the bloodline of Muhammad, and generally speaking, that turned into the Shia religion, whereas the tradition that said, no, he has to be an imam, he has to be a religious leader, not a descendant, that's the Sunni religion, or basically those two branches.
Yep.
That's we have those two branches of Islam. One is all relatives. To be an imam in Shia means you can trace your lineage somewhere back to a relative or to a descendant of Muhammad himself. That's generally speaking how you become an imam. but that's not necessary on the Shia, on the Sunni side. So we see the same thing. Well, this Christianity avoided that problem simply by eliminating all the wives and children. You don't have to worry about them. And then you got people like Paul, who didn't even know Jesus, claims he saw him for a few hours on the road or something, and took over the entire religion. You know, that's what really happened. We should not be calling it Christianity. We should be calling it Paulism.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not just with Mormons for recent examples. You look at any denomination that popped up recently, you're going to have that same type of thing where if they have children, they'll have some kind of a special role. With the Branch Davidians, for example, they ran into some serious issues where they had several splits over, you know, who followed the son of their founder and who didn't.
Yeah,
In the Adventist Church, there was a scandal that came up where the grandson of James and Ellen White, he was actually the pastor of the church in Grants Pass where I grew up, but this was a little before my time. He had an affair, and he got special treatment because of who his grandparents were, and he didn't get fired.
Yeah, right. Well, and you see the Moonies, you know, Reverend Moon, the Moonies died. And see, now you got the struggle between his wife, who's, by the way, his second, and he's against divorce, by the way, his second wife and some of his children. And we're not sure how that's going to work with the Sun Yun Moon Church.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you see it all the time.
Yeah.
The whole reason I talk about this in the book is to show how sex or the lack of sexual stuff really plays into the way the whole religion developed. And it actually gave impetus and motivation for the writers of those books in the New Testament to get rid of the women. I mean, you don't want sexual creatures. You don't want sexuality. You don't want grandkids or kids around, because all those things exude somebody screwed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have that if you're trying to have this ascetic, asexual approach, which Paul and the rest of his gang were trying to do. Are we having fun yet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I'm learning here.
Okay. So what's on our agenda?
Oh, this was... You're done on that? There is a Gnostic sect that you would have really gotten a kick out of. You can find them in the Nag Hammadi scriptures. And I can look it up and send you the details on it, but I actually presented a seminar on it presented a class on it in my seminar in Gnosticism when I was in the seminary. And it was libertine Gnosticism, which was very shortly lived, pretty unpopular, and greatly, greatly persecuted by anybody and everybody, including other Gnostics. And what separated them from everybody else is their religion was centered around sex in the exact opposite direction of Christianity.
Their
church services were basically orgies.
I'm in for that religion.
Wow.
Yes. So they'd get together and have sex. Now, where it got weird was they didn't allow you to have sex for procreation. So you'd have to pull out. And if the woman got pregnant, they'd abort every single pregnancy because they viewed the creation of matter as being evil.
Oh.
And it was the reason why they would indulge themselves, and not just as far as sex goes, but they'd indulge themselves in every way imaginable. They were very much hedonists. Is they had a very strong dualistic worldview. All Gnostics did, where there's this stark difference between matter and spirit. And with that distinction, they viewed it as the matter is evil, the spirit is pure, so it doesn't matter what you do with your body. It's already evil. It's already gone. It's worthless. So yeah, do whatever. And they would do whatever with, you know, having sex with each other. Whereas the ascetic Gnostics, which was the much more popular version of it, they would deny sexuality. They would just straight up prohibit sexuality of any and all kinds. And they would do a lot of flagellation and other punishment of themselves. But it was also based on that dualism. But in that case, it was because the body is evil, you have to punish it.
Yeah, right.
And that concept has definitely been reintegrated back into mainstream Christianity.
Yeah.
Gnosticism wasn't completely destroyed. It was, a lot of it was just absorbed back in.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And it keeps cropping up in various forms. I mean, if you really study the various denominations today, you can trace them right back to other groups that were back in the first and second and third centuries, for sure. I mean, a lot of Arians, or I mean, I think you could probably equate, not equate, but you can see very strong similarities between, say, the Aryan beliefs about the Christology of Jesus and the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
Mormons have a very different view of the Jesus figure than Christians do. That's why I claim that, and I'm adamant, Mormons are not Christians. I don't know what they are, but they're not Christians. And I list them among the four Abrahamic religions. There's not three.
Yeah, they are definitely very distinct.
Yeah. Well, their beliefs are so different. There's no belief in the Trinity. Well, that's a pretty basic thing for Christianity. It has been since Constantine or even earlier. And that's what the whole Arian heresy was all about. You know, mm-hmm. They weren't too wild about the Trinity idea. So they got kicked out, and Arians got put exiled, and they got persecuted for saying that Jesus wasn't really a God until he died.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of other heresies like that. But I would like to talk about recovering from religion.
Yes, that was going to be next.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to talk about it a lot. Just to let people know that it's growing rapidly. I started it 3 years ago, and we've got a whole team of people helping us work on it. And we've probably got somewhere between 100 and 150 groups meeting fairly regularly.
Oh, very nice. People
around coming together once a month to talk about the problems of dealing with, you know, I got a religious spouse. What do I do? Or, a lot of our groups met this last month before Christmas to talk about, you know, I'm going home for Christmas. I don't have to deal with all this religious crap. What do I do? And, how do I deal with the holidays? What happens if somebody wants me to pray? You know, there's just all sorts of things that a lot of us are long since beyond. We don't worry about it, or it doesn't bother us anymore. But if you're newly out of religion, you have no place to go and talk about this stuff. And that's why I started recovering from religion, is because people need a self-help place. And it's kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. We call it RR. And what we found is if you take God out of it, you only need 10 steps. That's a joke, guys.
I laughed.
Not very well here.
Sorry, I haven't been drinking enough.
So it's Sarah Moorhead's been heading it up, and Jerry DeWitt. You know Jerry?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we had him on for the episode with him is to date our most popular.
Excellent, excellent. Well, he's quite a popular guy. He's
yes.
Yeah, his first book's going to come out in June, and I think it'll probably be well worth looking at, well worth reading.
Oh, very nice.
I too, of course, but yeah, I'd say Jerry'd be number three. I like Jerry. He's been our executive director for the last year or so, actually a little more than a year at RR. And so he's been going around getting new groups started. And Sarah Moorhead out of Jerry's in Louisiana, and Sarah's out of Omaha. And we've got a web designer and a web developer, and we got a group coordinator. We got about six people that spend a lot of time getting this thing going and organizing it and making sure teams or groups are meeting. And we've developed support materials for them. We got a great website, all sorts of stuff that will help support people. If you think about it, there's not been that kind of support out there. If you left religion, you just were on your own, period. And if you went to an atheist meeting or a, you know, free thought meeting or skeptics meeting, they don't want to hear your story. They don't want to hear how you're having trouble with your religious husband or wife. They've been there and done that. They're not a counseling service. So it's hard. And I've had so many people say, man, I went to the skeptics meeting and I didn't get any help. Nobody wanted to listen. Nobody wanted to tell me how I could deal with these things. So what we found is if somebody will come to a recovering from religion meeting or two or three, they get over their stuff and they move right on into the skeptics meeting or the atheist meeting. In other words, we are bringing more people into the movement because we're listening to them. And once you listen to them and they get it off their chest and they meet some other atheists and they realize nobody's eating babies for breakfast, then they start moving into the atheist, secularist, free thought groups. And we here in Kansas City get probably an average of three or four new members to our groups from RR every single month. Every month.
That's amazing.
Am I right in thinking that you're pretty much losing that many every month also? It's kind of like a constant turnover?
Absolutely. That's the problem. We're not like AA in that sense. We don't expect you to stick around forever. Right. You know, we just say, come, get it off your chest and move on. So some people, you know, come to two, three, four meetings and they move on. Here's the interesting thing. We have a lot of lifelong atheists show up at our meetings, and they still have issues. They've just never had to talk about them. One of the early meetings I did, we had two lifelong atheists show up at our meeting. I'm thinking, what are you doing here? You know, they're running atheist groups other places. What are you doing here? And the fact was, they had some issues they didn't know how to deal with. And there's nowhere to talk about them in their atheist groups, so they came to our group. I thought, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Makes perfect sense.
It does. I mean, it was one of them was one of them had a an issue with his religious mother-in-law, and he didn't know anybody to talk to about it, so we came to us. But that's the one initiative, and the newest initiative I've done about started a year ago with Han Hills out of North Carolina. He's been developing our web presence for this one. It's called the Secular Therapy Project, and we went live in May with the project. But the purpose of the Secular Therapy Project is to get a listing service for secular therapists, because there's a hell of a lot of therapists out there, but they are not necessarily secular. And they may be Baptist, they may be Buddhist, but they're not secular. And you can end up going to therapy with somebody who advises you to go back to church, or ought to meditate more. You should pray, or here's a meditation book, and it just happened to come from the Seventh-day Adventist church or something like that, you know. So what I kept hearing over the years since the God Virus was published was, I can't find a therapist that's not religious. And lo and behold, I got out and started looking, tried to help these people find a secular therapist, and I couldn't find them. They are hard to find, and yet I know they're out there. Well, why are they hard to find? Well, if you are a therapist, if you are a secular therapist in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you said atheist, you'd lose half clients overnight.
Mm-hmm. You'd lose the other half within a couple of days.
And yeah. Referral sources, like a lot of referrals come from churches and ministers and hospitals. And here's the kicker, judges. A lot of people sent to therapy from the courts. Well, judges are oftentimes very religious. I mean, you see that in the South especially. And if a judge found out you're an atheist, they're not going to send a guy or a gal to have therapy with you. So you could literally lose your entire practice just by being secular or being overtly atheist. So what we did was develop this site like a dating site, like Match.com. Mm-hmm. And the therapist registers with us, but they do it in an anonymous way. They are in control of what the public sees. Only Han and I know who they are and where they're exactly located. But the public see, you know, here's the description of Dr. Jane Doe in Tulsa. And you can register. If you guys are looking for a therapist in Idaho or, you know, Portland or wherever, you go on our site and register as a potential client, which opens the whole website to you, and you can just search by zip code, and you'll find that there's two therapists in Portland. There's none in Boise, by the way, that I know of. Is that a surprise?
No.
So, but then you can, through our system, email them, and you still don't know who they are, and they don't know who you are, but it's confidential. You can email and go back and forth until you're satisfied that you do want to work with this therapist, and then you'll make an appointment. If you can't find a therapist in your area, we have a lot of therapists that will do distance counseling. They'll like we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. Talk over Skype or by phone, and I'd say about a third of the therapists will do that. We have 91 therapists registered right now, mostly in the United States, but we do have two in Canada, one in Australia, and two in the United Kingdom. So it's even gone international. We didn't plan on that. And
that's impressive.
Yeah, our goal is to get 200 therapists registered by the end of this year, by 2013. So if you or your listeners know a good secular therapist, tell them to register with us. You don't automatically get in because you apply, and then there's four of us on our vetting team. We look at your application as a therapist to see, we want you to prove that you're truly secular. You know, there's lots of ways to do that, but just register with us and we'll make that final determination.
All right.
And if you're looking at us, register and see if there's your area.
And I've got to actually have notes.
I have one and possibly two that would be really interested in that, I'm betting, from my local atheist group.
Excellent. Well, tell them to get online and register because we need as many as we can. And there are a lot of atheists in the community that never show up to your groups.
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So they need therapy. They need help just like anybody else. And they may be afraid to go to groups because they're married to a religious person or something like that. Or it's a small community and everybody would know. So that's a problem. So we try to keep it as common as possible for the therapist and client. It's not foolproof, but... but it's a hell of a lot better than what was there before. So that's our therapy project.
Very nice.
And maybe a small plug for Rich and Deanna Joy.
Oh, I love those guys. I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, they run our official podcast for Recovering from Religion. Yeah.
Yeah, we've just been hitting all around you. We interviewed them too.
Oh, you did? Mm-hmm. Oh.
Lovely. Yeah, lovely guys.
Have you ever heard Rich's early podcast? I think it was like
number four. Yeah.
I recommend that to everybody.
Oh, yeah. You
know, can't we? I mean, you can edit me out if you don't like it.
Yeah. Was it Too Fucked Up to Fuck?
Yep.
Yeah, that class. That's go down in the annals of podcast history. Just the title alone, I think, is worth that.
Yes.
Easy free. No, they've done great work. The minute I met them, I was on the Atheist Experience about maybe a year and a half ago with Matt Delahunty. I was just on it last month again, but and Matt said, well, there's some guy who used to be a minister wants to talk to you and he's going to call in. So I said, sure. Okay. So we're on the show and this guy calls in and it turns out it's Rich. Hmm. And I didn't know Rich from Adam. And he starts telling us his story. You know, I just found this guy's fascinating. I need to know more. So he and I connected after the show. I think I called him a day or two later and we just had the greatest connection. And they were doing this, they were starting this podcast. So we kind of put our heads together and say, well, our needs its own podcast. So would you guys do it? And they said, sure. So they're the official podcast of Recovering from Religion. And awesome. They really have done, I don't know how much you've listened to their podcasts. They're not out.
Oh, yeah. All of them.
Yes.
What a service to the community. That if you're having any kind of trouble, all you have to do is listen to their podcast because there's somebody's had the same problem on that podcast. I think they're doing such an amazing service to not just for the recovery community, you know, anybody that's recovering from religion. So. Plus, they're just darn fun people. I'm going to try come to the convention. I'm going to try to spend a couple extra days and go up to Seattle and see them and maybe talk at one of their groups up there too.
Hmm. But excellent.
Mainly just see them. I haven't seen them since the Reason Rally. We connected there. Had a few beers. Didn't have a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got to get to bed, guys. Oh. It's a lot.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure. You guys are fun to talk to.
Yeah, and we'll be seeing you again here just in April.
Yeah, April's coming up soon.
So everybody listening, you want to see Daryl Ray's keynote address at the Northwest Freethought Convention, April 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah, I'll be talking about underwater basket weaving.
Nice. Looks like we have something in common.
So you're doing a workshop on that as well?
Doing naked underwater basket weaving, yeah. Jerking your chain, guy. Actually, February 2nd, I fly to Australia. I'm going to do a little speaking tour there, too. I've got, mainly it's for vacation. I've never been to Australia, but I've got groups in Sydney and Brisbane that I'm going to talk to while I'm there. That'll be fun, talking to Aussies about sex and God. So, all right, well, I'm going to sign off, get my little head to bed.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com, contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com, or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zoom, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.
What part of Phoenix? What part of Arizona?
I said Phoenix, but Glendale to be precise.
Oh, God, please cut that out.
No. Or if I do, it'll be in the bloopers.
All right. So I really hope I'm saying this right. The Tata's Moda.
No, you're not saying that right.
I probably shouldn't put the S on there. yeah. Sorry. I just keep seeing it.